The following is a paid commercial program. Unless otherwise identified, the guests on the program are employees of or otherwise represent the advertiser. The opinions expressed therein are those of the advertiser and do not necessarily reflect the views and policies of 640 Toronto.
This is Hi-Fi Radio with Wolfgang Klein and Jack Hardim. Toronto's news, today's talk, 640 Toronto.
Welcome, my friends. Another week. Hopefully another buck. Hopefully at least hung on to your money. Yep, it's a environment where he who loses the least wins. Zen, my friends, this is a market that requires Zen. And certainly I've been internalizing the market action for the last 6 months, I shall say. And the long-term trend for investing is about as clear as it gets. You buy good stuff and you hang on for decades. The Warren Buffett style of investing, it works. But between here and there, the ride that you have to endure is fierce. But that's just the way it is. You know, the risk-free investment environment pays you about 3% historically. Right now, you can actually get GICs for 4%, not bad. But the long-term track record of the stock market is twice that. In fact, it's greater than twice that. It's about 10 or 11%. And that is the way you can build wealth. And that's why you get twice the return, basically, in stocks over bonds. But again, there's a ticket to pay for it, and it's called volatility. Again, a few points, and Jack and I are in the process of writing some notes to our clients about Zen and wealth management. And that is life, my friends, as you know, is very temporary. And when you parlay that into the world of investing, when your account hits an all-time high, say to yourself and remind yourself, this is temporary and it could recede from here immediately, but ultimately the trend should continue to push it higher. So the point there is, elevate the highs. Don't high watermark your portfolio mentally. And don't, my friends, do not mentally spend that money or book that money as a fait accompli. Unless, of course, you exit the market, sell, and leave and call it done. At which point, I think you'd find a challenge to get yourself back into the market. I flip that around. When your market is making, or your account is making, is receding and is giving back ground, which is really all we are doing. If you're a long-term investor, you're giving back some ground here. Again, remember, it is temporary. And it could, in fact, get worse. So, however, temporary as it may be, when markets do hit bottoms and they turn, and they can often turn very quickly. My next point I'm going to make before I introduce my next guest is, if you want to hit the low, if you want to hit the low, my friends, you got to be there. Endure the pain. You will hit the low. You'll nail the low. And then watch your account continue to move in the direction. I'll summarize. Markets two-thirds of the time go up, one-third of the time they go down. And over the long haul, over decades, you almost have a 99% probability stocks will outperform bonds. So with that, setting the table, Austin Moeller, one of our defense analysts, a brilliant man, a world traveler. He's had a wonderful discussion about Berlin. His grandfather's from Germany. Of course, my ancestors are all from Germany. So we had a lovely discussion about Berlin, a city, as you all know, that was completely leveled and annihilated by the Allies to put Hitler to bed and end, hopefully, the war that was to end all wars. But, of course, as you all know, friends, and the story has died, and we have to keep the story elevated, is Russia has invaded Ukraine. And the story is being buried. I'm not happy about that because each and every day people are being murdered. A genocide is taking place again. And the good news is I believe in human mankind. That will end and the city will have to get rebuilt. But between here and there, I understand, Jack, you mentioned to me that there's a shortage of bombs. And in fact, the Western allies are perhaps running short on missiles to help the Ukraine defend themselves. Austin, Jack, please, thank you very kindly. Welcome. And a lot to talk about here, but let's speak initially about how the Western alliance is doing. What's the situation in terms of munitions and bombs? Where do we go from here? Austin, over to you.
Great, Wolf. Thanks, Wolf. Great to be with you. So as you said, we are currently in sort of the war of attrition stage between Russia and Ukraine, and this is at the point where it's just going to come down to which side is able to produce munitions and have an economy strong enough to overcome the other to make a decisive change on the front lines of the battlefield. And as you've mentioned, the U.S. and NATO and the West in general have been sending tons of arms to Ukraine, mainly weapons that they can actually use, like anti-tank weapons, including the Javelin and the TOW and the NLAW, as well as Eastern European countries that are now part of NATO and the European Union, like the Czech Republic and Romania and Poland, have been shipping old Soviet-era vehicles and weapons to Ukraine because those weapons the Ukrainian army already knows how to use. But like everything right now, we are in the middle of a supply chain crisis, and most of the Western allies, including the United States, have not stockpiled huge numbers of artillery pieces and drones and anti-tank missiles to fight a protracted months-long or years-long war against a mechanized, relatively modern military opponent like Russia. So the number of anti-tank weapons and munitions and artillery shells that are being made available to Ukraine are running out. And it's going to take time for the defense contractors in the West to be able to manufacture additional munitions to send to Ukraine. In the meantime, Russia has the opposite problem. Russia can reach deep into the Soviet stockpiles to pull out more tanks, and we've already seen them doing that. They've been pulling out 45-year-old tanks like the T-80 and the T-62M, which are, they're incredibly old, but you can stick them on a train and ship them in from Siberia, and old tanks still kill, right? So they still have thousands of tanks at their disposal that they can get up and running and ship to the front. So we could end up in a scenario where Ukraine and the rest essentially run out of weapons before Russia runs out of tanks. Now, Russia's problem, of course, is, A, they're heavily sanctioned, so they're having various supply chain issues of their own, including getting thermal optics to be able to put into drones and weapon sights and tanks, as well as getting their hands on drones, which they've largely been getting from the Chinese. We're currently in having their own supply chain issues, but most importantly, the Russian army is running out of men. They raised a force of about 200,000 men, mainly contract soldiers, along with conscripts, to send fight the Ukraine war. But unfortunately for them, Ukraine is the largest country in Europe. It's about the size of Texas, and it requires far more men to actually take Ukraine, since the government actually stood up against them and didn't collapse like was expected, perhaps in an Afghanistan-type scenario. And so now they've sustained tremendous numbers of casualties. I mean, if you look at the first 30 days of the war, they were taking extremely high World War I-type battle casualties. The estimates are that the Russia, if you include their client states like the Donetsk and the Luhansk People's Republics, they probably got about 20,000 dead, and probably a similar proportion of wounded and deserters. So that would probably put their casualty account somewhere around 40 or 50,000, which if you look at the force they raised originally, that doesn't leave to continue their campaign. And that's why they pulled out of their campaign in Kyiv to take the capital. That's why they pulled out of their campaign in Kharkiv. They just don't have enough men left. And so now they're taking everyone they have left and they've thrown it at the Donbass, because they've essentially decided that now the key focus of this war is to take the Donbass. And if they're successful in that, then it's possible that Putin may do a strategic pause and declare victory, essentially. But I'm somewhat skeptical that the Kremlin and Moscow will be willing to allow Zelensky and Kyiv to remain power, just given that was a core objective originally of this war, was regime change, because Moscow did not align with the Western-backed democratic government in
Wow. It sounds like a complete miscalculation on the resources, not only to take Ukraine, but also to secure and hold it based on what Putin's expectations are and obviously what his initial goals versus what he's going to end up actually achieving at the end game here, Austin. But looking at the war, let's look at air superiority. Let's talk about Russia, air capabilities that they have. And also the importance of Western drones, because from my expectation, I would have expected Russia to have complete air superiority over Ukraine immediately and able to hold that with relative ease. But it seems like that's not the case. Could you maybe elaborate on that? And like I said, the importance of drones in this campaign?
Absolutely. So it was certainly the expectation, and it was my expectation originally when I was writing about this and my views that this war was going to happen, that Russia would be able to achieve air superiority probably within the first 2 weeks of the war. Russia has the world's second largest air force. They have a lot of very experienced pilots that have flown in Syria and in other places, was that they would be able to knock out the air defenses and achieve air superiority over Ukraine. Now, that has not happened, and that you have to sort of attribute to the fact that Ukraine is not just fighting as Ukraine, right? They have full access to U.S. military intelligence, which has given them a huge boost in being able to fight the Russian military, especially in the air. So there's a lot of stories that you'll read about where Ukraine had MiG-29s on the ground at an airfield, and then they got an intelligence tip that an airstrike was coming, and then they quickly scrambled the planes and moved them to another place. So there's been a lot of musical chairs going on with the Ukrainian Air Force to hide their, which allows them to be able to launch airstrike unpredictably. And then on top of that, they've made extensive use of drones, mainly the Bayraktar TB2, which they purchased from Turkey. That's been a huge force multiplier for them in this war. It's been hugely disruptive. It's very hard to see small drones flying at a low speed and a low altitude for a lot of air defenses, particularly Russia's Pantsir air defense systems. So they've had a lot of difficulties filling in the air defense gaps for their deployed ground forces, especially when they're moving in convoy. And that, of course, has resulted in huge casualties for the Russian army.
Friends at home, a quick break. We're going to get back with Austin Moeller, defense analyst. We're talking military strategy and, good golly, a potential end to this war. We'll have to get that opinion from Austin as well. Good friends, quick break. Get right back to Hi-Fi Radio 640 Toronto.
Let's take a break. Wolf and Jack will continue their in-depth discussion about money. You're listening to Hi-Fi Radio on 640 Toronto. You're listening to a paid commercial program. Unless otherwise identified, guests on the program are employees of or otherwise represent the advertiser. The opinions expressed therein are those of the advertiser and do not necessarily reflect the views and policies of 640 Toronto.
Welcome back, my friends. Hi-Fi Radio. Chatting with my good friend, analyst in the United States with Canaccord, Austin Moeller. His grandfather immigrated from a city called Hamburg, home of the hamburger. And that was a little Rammstein queued up. We're talking about the invasion of Ukraine by Russia. God-awful event that we're witnessing right in front of our eyes, a story that's been buried, and I'm not happy about that. We have to keep the story elevated to put a quicker end to it. But again, as Rammstein puts it, du hast nicht. Translation, you have nothing. Hey? And I've said it before, the Ukraine should play the Rammstein as loud as it can, pointed at Moscow, and that's what they tell them. You have nothing. It's remarkable. The world was quite intimidated by the Russian military. And, well, the Western alliance is, and I don't want to jinx it, but demonstrating that perhaps they have less than we thought. Austin, of course, is talking about that. Jack is a former captain, I shall say, in the military. It makes him such a good partner of mine. A lot of benefits to working with people in the military because they think a certain way. And it's well, in the world of finance, you want to double check and triple check things as you do in the world, I guess, of military. Gentlemen, let's take this to Bay Street and Wall Street. Inflation has been running fierce. Jagmeet Singh on television last night, holding his baby, asking for the Liberal governments to offer support to people as interest rate rise and it's affecting people's monthly and daily cash flow requirements. I certainly don't think that the Liberal government should be handing out more money per se, but certainly we have to make some adjustments. And of course, this invasion of Ukraine by Russia is put a huge spike in food prices, huge spike in energy prices. And it's incredible that this war is also being affected by supply chain issues and exacerbating supply chain issues. I'm waiting for a car, and that's going to take some time to hit my driveway based on supply chain issues. So I guess first off, Austin, you're a military strategist. I'm doing a lot of work on this. Is there an end in sight to the aggression? And in terms of food coming out of that part of the world, what's the picture on that? Are they going to be able to export any grains and any of their resources that the world so requires? Again, 25% of so many items come from that part of the world. Austin, over to you.
Great. Yeah. So I'll start with the second question first. As you know, Ukraine is sort of known as the breadbasket of Europe. A huge portion of the world's grain comes from Ukraine, as well as raw materials for fertilizer. And a lot of that is being disrupted right now, of course, by the war, which is being fought in the grain fields and the steppes of the Donbass, where a lot of that grain is being produced. Additionally, Russia's navy has blockaded Ukraine's coast. So they have lots of grain silos in Odessa and other ports where they can ship the grain out. But Russia has blockaded those ports and actually as recently as yesterday has started conducting airstrikes on the grain silos. Because, I mean, part of it is, and also Russia's been confiscating grain and sending it home to Russia. And part of the strategy there is Putin believes he can put tons of economic pressure on the world in general. And to some degree, him and Nikolai Petrushev, one of his, highest officials that he is aligned with, seem to be in agreement that if there is a famine, that would help them in achieve their military objectives.
Jack?
I don't know what to say. That's a tough one, Wolf. But as you said, out of the gate, like Austin was one of the first people to really identify the threat of this special military operation. And you saw the buildup on the border there, Austin. So I'd really like to hear your thoughts on how this can get resolved, this conflict, and will get resolved over time, because I think that is a big question about, obviously, food shortages, energy issues that we're having, and just inflation in general. So I know you can't really give a timeline, but what's your expectation for how this conflict ends?
Sure. So, I mean, the number one problem for Russia right now continues to be manpower. They're running out of men from the original force that they mobilized to fight in Ukraine. And so Putin really has two options. He can take the Donbass with using tons of overwhelming artillery, as they've been doing over the past month, and he can declare a partial victory there and put some ceasefire, strategic pause, or end of the war. I'm somewhat skeptical that he won't come back later and try and attack Kyiv and take the capital as he originally planned. But without more men, that's going to be very difficult. And then his alternative to that would be he raises, he mobilizes 300,000 or 400,000 more conscripts and sends them to fight in Ukraine. But that could be, of course, very unpopular at home. And of course, as a dictator, the number one thing you're worried about is preserving your own power. Dictatorships have a lot more leeway to be able to fight a war much longer than a democracy can, as they're not subject to elections. But even at home in a dictatorship, discontent can get so high that you risk being overthrown and losing your power. So it's possible that if Russia is successful in the Donbass, the war could end there, at least for some period of time. And it's possible that they may not be successful in the Donbass, and they may stall out as they did in Kiev and Kharkiv. And if that happens, then Moscow and the regime there is going to be in serious trouble and at risk of a major coup, because they'll have a huge number of casualties and nothing to show for it politically in terms of military gains.
We speak with Austin Moeller. He's a... Sorry, Jack. Austin Moeller on the line with us here of Hi-Fi Radio, of course, if you're just tuning in. Austin's a defense analyst with Canaccord, an inside view on the conflict in the Ukraine, and of course, the effects on your pocketbook, the effects on your RSP, how it's affecting the landscape. But Jack, if you don't mind, I just want to ask Austin while we have him on the line. Austin, what are your views for 2023? What do you see next year? We're already halfway through this year, and I think the immediate trend is going to be more of the same. But I am a little more optimistic about next year. Can you share in my optimism, or do you remain quite perplexed as to how we're globally going to work our way out of this funk that we're in?
Sure. I mean, I guess it'll depend on how things play out with the Federal Reserve and interest rates over the next several months. And, if growth slows and we do go into some sort of recession, how long the duration of that recession might be. If we look specifically at the defense sector, though, because of the Ukraine war, it's been relatively insulated from a lot of the economic risks right now. I mean, if you look at what the House Armed Services Committee just passed yesterday, they added another $37 billion to the fiscal year 23 budget draft. So that'll get you to the largest U.S. defense budget ever of around $810 billion.
Wow.
And so we'll see what happens ultimately with the November elections. I know that the Republican ranking members, the number twos on the Armed Services Committees within Congress, have been pushing for additional defense funding on top of what was planned in the Biden administration's draft to counteract inflation. So they want somewhere between 3% and 5% real growth on the budget on top of whatever inflation is going to be. So that could be, a way that we could see defense stocks outperforming some of the rest of the market, just given the current conditions, especially into fiscal year 23, if Congress changes hands.
Can you give us a couple of preferred picks right in here, Austin?
Sure. So, I mean, I continue to recommend AeroVironment, ticker ABAV. They manufacture what's called the Switchblade loitering munition. It's essentially a kamikaze drone that you launch, and it has a range of between 10 and 40 kilometers, and it can chase down a tank and it explode and blow it up. So they've shipped about 700 to 1,000 Switchblade drones to Ukraine. But the real opportunity is they've been in discussions with potentially selling these drones to up to 20 NATO countries, which would really be the incremental upside opportunity there. I've also continued to recommend Kratos, ticker KTOS, which has extensive exposure to drones and hypersonics as well. Obviously, Russia's been using hypersonic missiles in Ukraine, as well as Maxar Technologies, ticker MAXR, which just won a $3.2 billion contract from the National Reconnaissance Office to continue providing surveillance services to the U.S. government.
Jack, we got about 90 seconds. Do you have any final questions for our dear guest, Austin Moeller?
Well, just looking at 2023, like you said, Wolf, I think it's the key risks are the Fed, as Austin talked about, the Ukraine war, and a potential recession. So the fact that that Russia seems to be stalling, at least in Ukraine, tells me that there may be hopefully a shorter resolution to this and a positive outcome for 2023. So I just like to say that I think that was a quite positive comment that that Austin made and potentially positive for the 2023 outlook.
Let's hope the communication lines open up in Russia as well, that the people get the real news as to what's taking place. 15 seconds, is there any change in the media ban in Russia, or is the truth getting through? And again, you got 15 seconds for this, Austin.
I would say that there's still an extensive amount of propaganda in Russia. I'm sure there's a lot of people in Russia who don't believe it, but also it's pretty much all they're hearing in the media and in social media, that they need to fight this war against Ukraine and against the government in Kyiv.
Yeah, sad. Austin Mueller, I want to wish you a great weekend. Thank you very kindly for the brilliance and update on the situation. Very, very insightful, and thanks for your top picks as well. Appreciate that. Friends, we're going to take a quick break and get over with our friend Don Velo. He's a market technician, a seasonal investor, and a man with about 50 years of experience on Bay Street. You want to stay tuned for this. You're going to learn something. Hi-Fi Radio 640 Toronto.
Don't go anywhere. There's more Hi-Fi Radio in a moment on 640 Toronto. You're listening to a paid commercial program. Unless otherwise identified, guests on the program are employees of or otherwise represent the advertiser. The opinions expressed therein are those of the advertiser and do not necessarily reflect the views and policies of 640 Toronto.
At first I was afraid, I was petrified, kept thinking I could never live without you by my side. But then I spent so many nights thinking how you did me wrong, and I grew strong.
A little spring in my stride here this evening. I tell you, it's been a tough 6 months managing money. A lot of hand-holding and, well, some long faces. It happens. Everything is temporary, my friends. Good days, bad days, they're all temporary. But over the course of time, own good stuff, you're going to do very, very well. And importantly so, when you're building a wealth creation plan. It's a plan of decades. It's a plan of consistency. Every paycheck, take some money aside and invest. And that way you're going to buy on weakness and you buy in strength. And in weakness, you buy a little more. And on strength, you buy a little less. They call that dollar cost averaging. It works. The math doesn't lie. And if you want the real fruit, Jack continuously reminds us about Warren Buffett. Jack, tell them all about Warren Buffett and when he made his money, and but as well as long as he's been an investor.
Well, he's always been an investor, Wolfie, and we talked about it, that a lot of billionaire investors actually started with paper routes. So they started very early, and they used time and compounding on their side. And believe it or not, but I think Warren Buffett generated 99% of his wealth after most people retire. He developed it or generated it after the age of 60, if you can believe it.
Yep, 95% of Buffett. And Buffett's worth, my good friends, I believe it's about $100 billion, maybe $120 billion. So Warren Buffett made approximately, call it $95 billion post age 60. Did he work harder? Nope. Did he work longer hours? Nope. Did he work smarter? Probably not, although he gets, I think, smarter each and every day. It was all about the math of compounding. Compounding takes decades, but once you lay down 3 or 4 or 5 decades of building wealth, the exponential change is remarkable. In other words, 5% on a billion is less than 5% on 100 billion. And if you want some misery as company, Buffett probably has lost the most amount of money this year. Yes, Buffett would probably be down $20 billion this year. So if you're down 100 grand or 10 grand or 50 grand, you can laugh at Buffett. He's down $20 billion this year alone. Does he care? No, because he knows it's temporary. Don Velo, seasonal investor, chartered market technician, veteran of Bay Street, author, and a very passionate man, also spends a lot of his time driving cancer patients to treatment, part of his retirement. But he's very passionate about the markets and never takes his eye off the ball. I receive a morning comment from him each and every day. Tech talk, pre-opening comments, loaded with charts, loaded with information. Thank you, Don. Welcome back, my good friend. You know what's standing out to me right here, right now? Oil has been obliterated. Oil was the darling, the only sector to rise on Bay Street and Wall Street for that matter. This is the only sector that's up this year is energy. But the month of June has been atrocious to it. And I will say, I saw some numbers. With this kind of a give back, historically speaking, there's never been an occurrence when oil has fallen this much in a month and it didn't move higher 12 months later, according to, I can't remember who wrote the piece. You saw it this morning too as well, Jack. So Don, let's start with energy. Do you sell your oil stocks here? Do you buy your oil stocks here? Or do you zen in the art and just close your eyes and leave them alone?
Well, it's a good example, Wolf, of how these markets move. Clearly, we've seen a huge drawdown in North American equity markets since the beginning of the year. There's an indicator that tells you that. It was Bank of America has a bull and bear indicator for the S&P 500. It can register from 0.0 to 1 or to 10, 0.0 being extremely bearish and 10 being extremely bullish. You can pretty well guess where it is right now. It's at 0.0, and it just started to come higher right now. That's the same level it was back in March of 2020 when the COVID-19 scare happened. We've seen the S&P 500 down 24% since the beginning of January, NASDAQ since last November down 35%, and even the TSE Composite is down 15%. But it tells you, these are cycles that the markets go through. You're mentioning oil, a good example of oil. Historically, the energy stocks have a difficult time going into the springtime, and then usually right around fall of each year, they have a nice move on the upside. So, sure, they come down a long ways, but the whole way of looking at it is that the weakness we've seen in equity markets and in the oil sector ultimately provides a buying opportunity at the right price.
Jack, you've been saying frequently, and again, I can throw it back to you, Jack, your quote about, you know, the price you pay, as eloquently as you can share with the audience, because there's a lot of wisdom in this. Friends, pay attention to what Jack's about to say. Jack, go for it.
Just goes to what Don's talking about, Wolf. If you pay less for something, meaning if you pay less than what the average is, I'm going to say that the multiple for the S&P 500 historically is 15 times earnings. If you pay 10% less than that, then you would expect over the long term, and when I say long term, I'm talking over the next 10 years, to generate an extra 1% on top of the normal S&P 500 return. So what that means is if the S&P has historically generated 1% or 10%, then you'd expect to generate 11. So simple stuff, but it's true. And if you overpay for something, doesn't mean it's the end of the world, Wolf. It just means that if you overpay by, say, 20%, then potentially your longer term return would be, call it 8. So again, not the end of the world, but people tend to behave like it is with the behavioral biases and emotions. When the market goes sour, they tend to bail at the wrong time when they should be buying, as you said just yesterday in the office.
The price you pay matters, my friend. If you overpay for something, it doesn't mean you can't make money, as Jack's pointing. It just means that your future average return will be less. So again, right here, right now, Don, again, the market's down 25%. And though I don't think the market was excessively priced, but against the interest rate changing backdrop, perhaps it was. But at these levels, would you say that the market is fairly valued, again, based on interest rates and based on, you know, the next 12 months of growth or lack thereof? How do you think the market is fundamentally priced on, fairly below value or still above value, or above average value?
Yeah, it's fascinating to see how these things are evolving. We are actually seeing North American equity markets enter into a very important time in history. Historically, we've seen North American equity markets in their 10-year cycle, they have a history of bottoming in the second year of the 10-year cycle. So this is the second year, that's 2022. So you would normally expect the markets, both U.S. and Canada, to bottom right around June of 2022. Looks like we might have seen that. Looking at the U.S. presidential cycle, interesting. Look, it's a four-year cycle, and the S&P 500, on average, reaches a very important low right around the end of June, in the second year after the president's been elected. And that's because the president does all kinds of difficult things in the second year of his presidency, and markets don't like that very much, and they tend to move markets lower in both in the U.S. Markets. Now, looking at another study, this was done by Equity Clock. They look at the U.S. presidential cycle when there's a change in the presidency from one party to the next. And no surprises here. The low in the U.S. equity market during the four-year cycle then, happens to be right around June of the second year after the president was elected.
That's a good factor. Don, we have to take a quick break, but you've given us 3 points of optimism, slightly longer-term optimism. That's really what I want the listeners at home to sort of hang their hat on. It will serve them well over time. Quick break, Hi-Fi Radio, Jack Hartle, producer, myself, Wolfgang Klein, portfolio manager, along with Jack, of course. Questions for us between now and then, wolfgangklein.com. Quick break, get right back to the show. Thank you.
Want to make more money? Stay tuned for more Hi-Fi Radio on 640 Toronto. You're listening to a paid commercial program. Unless otherwise identified, guests on the program are employees of or otherwise represent the advertiser. The opinions expressed therein are those of the advertiser and do not necessarily reflect the views and policies of 640 Toronto. Money.
Hey, welcome back, my friends. That's what the show's all about. We want you to have more of it. And sometimes we have to keep you from yourself. You know, let's talk gut feel for 30 seconds. Gut feel is pretty good. Gut feel can serve you well in many aspects of life. But I'm going to table, I'm going to question Jack and Don, and you 10-second answer. What do you think, guys, when it comes to the market? Follow your gut or be counterintuitive and go against your gut, to make an outsized return? Jack, I'm going to start with you and throw that question to Don.
Yeah, you need to look at what history tells you. And based on that, you look at what the market's currently doing. A good example of that, during the last week, we've seen short-term momentum indicators for both the TSE Composite and the S&P 500. Turn finally higher, which is the first indication that history is going to repeat, implying that the likelihood of recovery from a very important low in June has already started.
You got to go against your gut, Wolf. You got to make the difficult trade, and that's typically the right one.
The tough trade is the right trade, and the tough trade is gut-wrenching. So, friends, please, in this world, trust me, don't follow your gut. Follow the math. Just follow the math, and the math says just keep buying consistently little pieces of good stuff. See, you can't buy a little piece of a cottage. You're buying the cottage or you're not buying the cottage. That house that you love, no little pieces. Even a condominium, you sort of got to buy the whole piece with the bank as your partner. But when it comes to the equity market, you can buy one share of Suncor, one share of Microsoft to get yourself started. Don't advise that, but you can do that. You can buy little pieces of it along the way to help average out your price point. So Don, when there's a change in presidency, the market too historically then has found a low in the month of June. I'm going to say, and this is very interesting because I'm writing notes to my clients to convey my thoughts along with Jack's on the market. And again, we continuously speak in the world or try to communicate in the world of probabilities. There is no guarantee in what I am saying is going to be correct. We are trying to speak in high probable manner, but again, outside erroneous, you know what I'm talking about. Weird things can happen. Long tail events can happen that can throw the averages out of whack. So, you know, with that on the table, you're really the only guy speaking perhaps that a low in June is in. And I'm going to say there's a probability it's 30% a low is in. I think consensus remains that a low won't be made until there's a pivot in the Fed. Sorry, guys, technical speak. What we're talking about is the central banks globally are raising interest rates. When they give the market a signal that they're going to stop raising rates or not raise rates as quickly as, 75 basis points, that will give the market reason to change direction from trending lower to trending higher. So what do you think, Don? What's the probability of a low being in today, June, as you've been discussing, versus the probability of a low for the market coming in the fall versus the probability of a low for the market coming in next year? So three outcomes.
Yeah, very important. The market is focusing on interest rates, and clearly the market is anticipating an increase in interest rates going forward. That's the main reason for the weakness in equity markets. But the thing is, markets has already anticipated major increases in interest rates. Mm-hmm. We saw the CPI in the U.S. 8.6% last week, and we saw the in Canada CPI was up by 7.6%, I believe. So these are huge numbers. The thing is that the market has fully anticipated these increases in numbers. And the question is, where is inflation going from here? And something to watch very shortly, there's something called the PCE Inflation Index or Price Index coming out on June the 30th in the United States. And it'll give a pretty good indication if the inflation rate in the States has passed its peak. If there's a perception that the inflation rate in the U.S. has passed its peak from that report, there's a pretty good chance that'll happen. And that's going to be the setting up for equity markets to move significantly higher going through the rest of this year.
More optimism. And Jack, you picked up on the bond market action this week, where interest rates, i.e. yields, actually fell quite significantly on the 10-year. Briefly speak to that. What is the bond market telling us, Jack?
That's telling us exactly what Don is talking about, that, you know, potentially the rate of change for inflation has peaked. So if we're expecting a slower economy, then you would expect the yield, the amount that people would accept for the 10-year bond, to be lower. And that's exactly what we're seeing. So if that's the case, I would say that's very constructive for a bullish case for the market. So there's a lot of bearish cases out there, a lot of negativity. That may be a little green shoot that's peaking up here, that if we're past peak inflation and the market is expecting higher interest rates, there may be an opportunity for us to get a bit of a summer rally that people aren't really expecting.
Another point that I picked up this week, again, looking for market intelligence constantly to get clues, because the market is forward-looking and it's telling you a lot about the future if you pay attention to the details, which is what pros like Jack and I are paid to do each and every day. The government bond, interesting, there's a 30-year government bond constantly available. If you purchase the government of Canada, it's almost AAA, AAA bond 12 months ago, when they issued it at what's called par, which is 100. And 12 months ago, they promised you to give you your $100 back in 30 years, plus pay you interest each year of 2%. That was the government's promise, or is the government's promise to you. If you take that government bond 12 months later, i.e. today, and sell it, it's worth 25% less. That bond, the Government of Canada bond, has fallen 25% in 12 months or less. I couldn't believe that number. It's remarkable. And again, there's math behind it. It's all about duration risk or interest rate change. Interest rates go up, bonds go down. That marketable security is worth 25% less. If you hold it to maturity, I promise you, you'll get your $100 back because the taxpayer says so. But between now and then, you just took a huge haircut and was a very safe security. But Don and Jack, I also looked at the junk bond index, and it is down half of the market. It is only down 12%. So junk bonds are down 12%, whereas the Government of Canada bond is down 25%, and the stock market is down 25%. So what I'm seeing with junk debt, which is corporate debt, holding in much better, is reminds me that corporate balance sheets are fine. Companies don't go bankrupt when they have a strong balance sheet, which again is a signal of future optimism. My friends, stay the course. It's all about the long term. And if you're not sleeping at night, you have the wrong plan. Call us and we'll do a review for you. No charge. WolfgangKlein.com. Have a safe weekend. Have a prosperous weekend. Thanks for spending some time with us. We love you very much. All the best.
You've been listening to Hi-Fi Radio with Wolfgang Klein and Jack Harthill, portfolio managers at Canaccord Genuity Wealth Management. For questions about today's show or any questions about money, email wolfandjack@wolfgangklein.com. Hi-Fi Radio, for the love of money. Join us again next week. The preceding was a paid commercial program. Unless otherwise identified, the guests on the program are employees of or otherwise represent the advertiser. The opinions expressed therein are those of the advertiser and do not necessarily reflect the views and policies of 640 Toronto.
Hi, it's Shauna, and I might be a bad parent because my kids think french fries are vegetables.
Hey, it's Ryan, and I might be a bad parent because I went out for wings when my wife was in the hospital after giving birth.
Johnny here. I might be a bad parent because in my house, the tooth fairy gives pocket change.
But we're not alone. Len emailed us and said his six-year-old daughter's Tarzan moment going from love seat to lazy boy by curtains made him more proud than any dance recital.
And Andy left his two-year-old at the rink.
All right, guys, I'm sure we're not alone. Like Andy's kid.
For stories and confessions like this, make sure you check out our podcast.
It's called Bad Parents, and it's available wherever you get your podcasts.
I left a glove at the rink.